This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. State lawmakers were busy this past week pushing forward a variety of bills. Legislation requiring parental consent for birth control and STD treatment is making its way through the House. And the House expanded the list of public places where people can carry guns to include restaurants, bars, walking trails, and college campuses. That bill now moves to the Senate. Senate lawmakers tentatively approved a divisive abortion education bill, and Republicans outlined their plans for a big tax overhaul in North Carolina. We're going to talk about all that today. We're going to start with tax reform. WUNC Capital Bureau Chief Jessica Jones is here. Welcome, Jessica. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Republicans have been talking about tax reform for some time. What are their concerns? What was wrong with the old tax code that they felt they needed to address?
Well, to be fair, many people, both Democrats and Republicans, say that the tax code has needed revamping for a long time. Democrats just didn't want to touch that. And so now that Republicans are in charge, they would like to, you know, begin revamping the tax code. And so Republican leaders say that what they want to do is drop tax rates, not surprisingly. So right now, the plan would gradually drop the state's 7.75% personal income tax rate for the top bracket to 4.5% over 3 years. The corporate income tax would fall to 6%. And the estate tax would be eliminated, and services that are currently exempt from sales taxes would have to start charging a 6.5% sales tax. So that's basically the outline of the plan that was put forward, I should say, by leaders in the state Senate.
In the Senate, although the House is looking forward to it, Republicans are touting this as a tax cut. Here's Wake County Representative Tom Murray at a news conference.
We unveil our vision for tax reform in North Carolina. And it's tax reform that will help spur economic growth and provide for the people of North Carolina the largest tax cut in North Carolina history.
So that's State Senator Tom Murray. He is calling it the largest tax cut, but not all taxes will be cut. Is that right?
That's right. That was actually Senate President Phil Berger, who has really been out in front, who really has spoken out about trying to lower these tax rates. And tell me your question again. I was just thinking.
Well, he said the largest tax cut in North Carolina history, but actually taxes will rise on many items, including food and drugs.
That's right. So I guess I should just say that legislative researchers have released a report that says that the majority of taxpayers will probably be paying more taxes, not less, because when you go back and try to overhaul a state tax code, which of course is enormous, there are all kinds of things that you would have to do. And so a lot of especially low income to middle income people would actually be paying more. I do want to point out, though, just to be fair, that State Treasurer Janet Cowell, who is a Democrat, has said that the bond rating agencies have been coming to state officials for years saying that the sales tax needs to be broadened because people have not updated it. The sales tax is actually really sort of based on an old manufacturing economy, which the state no longer is, and that it needs to be broadened to include services. So I just want to put that out there. And I think, you know, that's a part of this that illustrates how complicated and huge the endeavor of trying to whip a state tax code into shape. It's an enormous task, enormous.
So widespread agreement that the tax code needs a new look, widespread agreement that our sales tax is antiquated and needs changing, maybe should include services. But the fact is taxes are going up for many, many people.
That's
especially
right.
When you start taxing food. Currently a 2% would go up to 6.5%, which is regressive. I mean, everybody buys food, and so that's going to affect poor people more than it affects people who have better incomes.
That's right. And advocates for low-income people say that that is going to be especially hard for people in that demographic. Also, prescription drugs will be taxed as well.
So there was a tax calculator used by the Republicans under the new rules. Married family of it's a tax calculator that appeared actually in the News and Observer, and they went out to see how people are going to fare under different conditions. So if you look at the NNO today, you'll see this tax calculator, and they talked to various people. And according to that, they said, well, a married family of three making $40,000 would actually pay more taxes than if that same married couple with three children were making $100,000. So the wealthier you were in that case, the better you did under this new plan. Is there any way, because the other question I have for you is Republicans are saying it's a $1 billion tax cut and It's a work in progress. We really don't know what it's going to do. I've heard both, and I don't know where they are at the moment on whether or not this is the final plan or whether this is a work in progress and they're not sure what the final outcome is.
Well, I think it's still a work in progress. You know, the Senate has sort of released the broad details of what they'd like to do, but House leaders have not. The governor on the campaign trail said that he would like to see some taxes lowered, particularly the corporate taxes, but we don't really have any specific plans from the others. And of course, everyone would have to come to consensus. And this is probably going to be a long-term endeavor. It's not something that can be decided in a week or a month or maybe even a year. I think it's a huge task. And you know, people are going to have to all be on board, relatively speaking, in order to make any kind of change.
And we talked about this, but the corporate tax would drop. And what's the reasoning behind this? Why do lawmakers want, Republicans anyway, want to drop corporate sales tax?
Well, so Republican leaders have been saying for a long time that if we drop the corporate taxes, then that's, you know, corporations in the state will expand. It'll attract more businesses to come. But one of the things that they haven't talked about is that there are many, many different kinds of businesses. Businesses are structured in many different ways, not just corporations. And a lot of economists point out that corporations are very, very good at taking as many tax breaks as they possibly can, especially these multinational corporations that are also located in North Carolina. And so there is some concern among the business community that if you lower the corporate tax, that small to medium-sized businesses might have to pick up a little bit more of that slack. Now, we don't know. State leaders, both in the governor's office and in the General Assembly, haven't really talked about that. But there are many different kinds of businesses, and lowering the corporate income tax is not necessarily a boon, economists say, to spurring on growth in business. And I think that's part of the Republican idea that's being presented, that if we lower these taxes, then business will flourish, and then there's this kind of trickle-down economic theory that's going to happen. But it's really hard to say what will happen in practice.
And tax is, of course, only one side of the ledger when it comes to budgeting. That's the income side. And if you get a $1 billion cut, you're either going to cut your budget by that much or you're going to have to make it up. What's the strategy for Republicans right now to make up the difference?
Well, they haven't laid out the full plan. That's the thing. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on, you know, they say more businesses will come here, more money will start flowing into the state, but they haven't spelled out all those details.
All right. Well, in keeping with our tradition and our custom of talking over the week's news with not the usual suspects, we have a roundtable today that consists of singer-songwriter Laura Lynn Dossett, artist and UNC art professor Ellen O'Hare Slavik, and Randall Keenan, who's a writer and associate professor of English at Duke. And I want to welcome all of you to be here. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Thank you.
Ellen, let's talk with you. You know, tax reform, if you're hearing this, on the one side, this antiquated tax, you know, we all pay taxes, right? And one way or another, you got to pay for services, and so you got to make the ledger balance. What do you think of this proposal?
Well, I think it's totally regressive, and the fact that wealthier people get cut and the poorer people pay more is just insane and illogical. But I would pay more taxes if my taxes went to mental health institutions and health care. But I don't want my taxes going to bail out corporations to make more profit. It doesn't make any sense to me. It absolutely seems backwards.
Well, the argument is if you attract those corporations, they're going to come here. And since there are more of them, you know, we'll get actually more money from them.
But they are coming here and they are here. And where's the money that we've been supposedly getting? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. The trickle-down economic theory that Jessica referred to doesn't work. It hasn't worked, I don't think. So I think it's ridiculous. I think to increase taxes on food when there's hungry children in this state is absolutely immoral.
It's a big one, too. It goes from 2 to 6.5% is the increase. Randall Keenan, how do you feel about
that? Well, yeah, I mean, the myth of increasing the economy by luring in more corporations. Most Fortune 500 companies pay no taxes at all. So, I mean, this is a shield. This is a smokescreen. It has nothing to do with how economies actually feed themselves.
Laura Lynn?
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking about with this is that there's also a progressive way of looking at reforming the tax code, which does involve taxing services. And I think that a piece of it that people don't understand about our state is that we haven't reformed the code in so long that that's part of the reason we're having such a big income problem right now. So when you're not taxing law services and you're not taxing your accounting services and you're not even, you know, I don't have a tax addition when my plumber comes. I mean, there are all kinds of services. I was thinking about on the way over if I have to invoice someone for singing at their wedding and I need to add taxes onto that, I think that that's okay. I have provided a service that is a real service.
Well, and we can't outsource that either, so we're not going to get somebody from Bangalore to do my wedding.
We cannot, right? And you're not going to get someone from Bangalore to do your will either. Yeah. You know, so there are a lot of practical services out there that we don't pay taxes on, and if they were taxed, everything could be taxed at a lower rate. So it doesn't have to be looked at. The fact that the rich are not being taxed as much as the poor is not the only issue involved.
Not the only issue, and it points to what you said right at the beginning, Jessica, which is the Democrats had decades to deal with this and didn't, and now they're sitting back in the minority, shooting salvos and making lots and lots of noise all of a sudden.
Right.
That's right. The people in the state knew this was coming, and they knew that different parts of the tax code needed to be reformed, like the sales tax. So, I think most people agree on both sides of the aisle that it needs to have a broader base. I mean, if only for the bond ratings, that would certainly be a good thing. But no one was really willing to do that hard work. Yeah. So that's where we are.
What feels so frightening is because we're so divided, this is definitely one of those issues that would require really careful and thoughtful bipartisan cooperation. And we're so not in that place right now that it's hard for me to imagine that anything would happen with us at all.
On the State of Things today, we're looking at the week in review with our roundtable. Jessica Jones, our Capitol Bureau Chief here at WNC. Laura Lynn Dossett is a singer-songwriter, artist, and UNC art professor. Ellen O'Hare Slavik and Randall Keenan, a writer and associate professor of English at Duke. Just ahead, abortion, education, parental consent for STD treatment, and more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking about legislation making its way through the General Assembly. With us, WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jessica Jones. And in keeping with our custom of talking about the news with folks who are not the usual suspects, we've assembled a panel of artists this week. Laura Lynn Dossett, a singer-songwriter. Ellen O'Hare Slavik, visual artist and UNC art professor. And Randall Keenan, a writer and associate professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jessica, Senate committee approved a bill that would require a certain kind of abortion education for the state's seventh graders. Tell us about that.
Well, so that bill actually was tentatively approved yesterday in the Senate, and it requires one more vote in order to move out of that chamber. And that would require a certain kind of abortion education for students who are in seventh grades and above. So it would affect high school students and some junior high students. And it would mandate teaching public school students that abortion is a cause of preterm births, among some other factors. And now before I go wading into this minefield, I just want to say that you hear this frequently from anti-abortion groups, and they will cite a lot of studies. In fact, they've been handed out at the legislature. I've received many of them. But abortion rights supporters refute that vigorously, and they say that anti-abortion groups are selectively using science to make that claim. And in fact, I also need to say that the country's leading medical associations say that abortion is not a cause of preterm births.
But there is some research that indicates a correlation between preterm births and abortion, and that is science. There is some science out there, right?
There are some studies that people on that side of the aisle will use. That's right.
But it's not conclusive, and there's other evidence to suggest that it's not a cause, but only a correlation at this moment.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that, about mandating, legislating the kind of things that we teach in school about reproduction. Laura Lynn Dossett.
Oh, I'm so sorry that you got to me first. I feel emotional about this one. I have three daughters, and so these are not hypothetical educational issues for me. First of all, I find it so offensive when science is used in that way, because there is no such thing as one study that says this thing. And there's so many factors that go into a person's long-term reproductive health. So that is just one factor that may or may not be true. It's just bad science to teach that. The idea that we're going to tell our teachers what they have to teach and that they would just do that because it's the law is frightening and ridiculous, and I think we'll have a lot of teachers in jail if that's what happens.
It's kind of interesting that the Republicans, who are known for espousing the cause of less government control and less government intervention, are now dictating what educators should do. Randall King.
How bizarre. How bizarre. I mean, the idea of mandating this idea. I mean, it's anyone who has read anything about science sees how this is clearly a misuse and misleading, quote-unquote, facts.
But let me be clear about two things. First of all, state legislatures do, at some level, don't they mandate what we need to know, how much you should know before you get out of 12th grade? I mean, that is the state legislature's responsibility to some extent. Jessica, right?
Sure, for a number of educational standards. But I guess I would say from my observation at the General Assembly, both Democrats and some Republicans are uncomfortable with this idea.
Mm-hmm. And this business, Ellen O'Hare Slavik, let me ask you about whether or not, you know, sort of one opinion is dominant, one scientific theory is dominant. You know, earlier in the week, and this month, the director of the State Department of Energy and Natural Resources has been widely criticized for changing that organization's mission statement to say that he will take into account a wide variety of opinions. But I kind of hear us saying, well, we shouldn't take one opinion. We should take in a wide variety of opinions. Where are we on this, Ellen?
Well, I mean, if they want to mandate that abortion is a cause for preterm labor, then they need to teach that exposure to asbestos and exposure to radiation and exposure to all kinds of other things cause problems in fetuses. I mean, x-rays harm you. As a pregnant woman, you should not have an x-ray. They're not going to be teaching all that. It's a very selective anti-abortion, anti-woman, anti-choice legislative move. And I think it is wrong to use the selective science. I mean, there's studies that say global warming is completely real. Are they mandated to teach global warming and climate change? No, I don't see that. So, if you know, it's so hypocritical and completely inconsistent and illogical.
And also, there is a certain amount of danger associated with having a child at the age of 11.
Well, exactly. And if you're going to start with seventh graders, you know, statistically, if you're a seventh grader and you're pregnant, you're most likely a victim of rape or incest. So you've got problems way larger than whether you may be able to have a child mm-hmm. later. So, you know, it's unsafe. It's unsafe information for our children to have.
Well, and that very point brings us to our next piece of legislation, which is one that would require bills that would require parental consent before teenagers can be treated for STDs or receive birth control. Tell us about that legislation, Jessica.
So lawmakers in committee have approved that bill, which would require minors to get notarized consent from a parent or a guardian to be treated for venereal disease, pregnancy, substance abuse, or mental illness. And of course, that bill would also apply to birth control prescriptions. And that was approved by the House Health and Human Services Committee. And I'm not sure when or if that's going to reach the House floor.
But it's on its way. It's going to be.
It's in the pipeline.
Right.
We'll see what happens.
So in this case, you need parental consent, and that sounds pretty sensible. Shouldn't a parent know if their child has a disease, Randall?
Well, I mean, the thing that outrages me about this is that it presumes an ideal family situation. You know, God bless the child who is not in a situation where that makes good sense or is even possible. So we're just going to discount these people.
Yeah, let me ask you, Laura Lynn mm-hmm. Dossett, what do you think of that parental consent? I mean, you're a parent, three daughters.
I am.
Don't
I
you
have three
know?
Daughters. Yeah, I do. I've actually said these words to my children. If something like this ever happens, if you're sick or if you're pregnant, I hope that we're in a situation where you can come to me and your father. If you can't, go get help somewhere else. You know, like it's not about my power as a parent. It's about the safety of my children. And so when I read this, it's so against my beliefs as a person, my philosophy as a parent, that I'm shocked by it. But you know, there's a whole professional level that there's also a huge problem. I mean, the ethical standards of counselors, social workers, doctors, this would go against their code, you know, so they would also have to be acting against their profession to to obey this law. Well,
and
you've
done some counseling and you've been trained. What, are counselors, are they not trained to encourage this child to bring the parents into it?
They are absolutely trained to encourage the child to bring parents or other responsible, helpful adults that are in their lives to be part of it. Absolutely. But they're also trained to spot danger and situations where a child would be hurt if they involve their parents.
Ellen?
Well, I just think if this becomes law, it's going to do exactly what they don't want it to do. There'll be more teenage pregnancies or preteen pregnancies. There'll be more STDs. As a child of two Catholic parents who I love dearly, and I'm also a mother of two children, I went to family planning in high school without my parents' consent, and I got birth control. And if I didn't get that birth control, I probably would have gotten pregnant. And I'm really glad I was able to do that. And I love my parents, but they're Catholic. They didn't believe in birth control. And I think they're probably grateful I went and got that birth control today. And so I it's absolutely crazy. I mean, and Randall said it presumes this ideal family, you know, in cases of incest or rape or just violence in the family, or you don't trust the family, you don't trust your parents, what do? You get sicker and you die because you don't have your parental consent. It's just, it does exactly what they don't want it to do. And the other thing I think about in this is somebody pointed out in Obama's first election that when Democrats are in power, there's fewer abortions. The abortion numbers go down. And I think it's because there's more access to birth control and sex education and funding for Planned Parenthood. And so when Republicans are in power, the abortion rates go up. And I think this is another example of that. If they put this in law, it's just going to make the problem worse, not better.
Randall?
And I just wanted to quickly add, in the last 13 years, in the 21st century, there have been significant outbreaks of STDs in rural and major metropolitan areas. This would be adding fuel to the fire. I mean, purely from a public health standpoint, it's a bad idea.
It's a really
bad Jessica,
idea.
Did that come up? That had to come up in terms of the opposition. Somebody would have said, well, then, if that's the case, if I had to tell my parent in order to get help, I just won't get help. So what it will really mean is fewer children getting help, not more parents being informed. That had to be raised on the floor. I wonder what the response to that critique has been or would be.
Right. Well, we'll see what happens when it gets to the floor. I mean, it's gotten out of committee and we'll see what happens, you know, when and if it lands on the floor. But that's certainly the criticism that you hear from people at the General Assembly for sure.
Also, legislation passed the House widening the number of places where people can carry guns. So more guns in our midst, perhaps. Where is it and what does the legislation do?
That's right. So state House lawmakers have given tentative approval to that bill, and that would allow concealed weapons on college campuses, at sporting events, in businesses serving alcohol, state parks, greenways, and you know, I think that there may be more. But essentially every public place. Now, private universities would be exempt, and the bill does not mean that you can carry a concealed weapon into a classroom. But if you're at a public university, the bill says that you would have to keep it in your locked car.
Oh, so it'd be locked away. You'd be safe.
In the parking lot.
Oh, I thought you could just have a gun on campus. But no, it's locked in your car and safe. Well, that's good. And then if you didn't like that, well, then just go to Duke. Just go to Duke. More guns in bars and sporting events where people are generally calm and emotionally under control. Gosh, what to say about this, Ellen?
The only basketball game I went to was when I first started teaching at UNC almost 20 years ago. I won a teaching award, and they gave it at the halftime of a basketball game. And I was a vegetarian, and I was so freaked out by the level of hatred for the other team that I went and ate a hot dog. I was hysterical. To imagine that there'd be guns at that event is crazy. And having taught on campus for close to 20 years, if I knew people had guns in their cars, I would feel – I've never felt the need to protect myself on campus. And if I knew people had guns, I would feel like I need to protect myself. So what? I go get a gun and then we all end up dead. I mean, there's no end to this. It's crazy.
What about those students who think that rate your professor is just not going far enough?
Well, I actually have to say, having organized a teach-in after 9/11, the Carolina Review basically called for people to beat me up in the parking lot. They didn't take it to the honor court. I have felt nervous because of my politics on campus. The police didn't return my call. This was years ago. I mean, I know you joke about it, but there is serious concern. I would be really nervous if I knew that those students who had said that years ago now had guns. I really would be quite scared.
Randall?
Well, I was thinking back 6-7 years ago when our UNC's student body president, Eve Carson, was kidnapped and murdered. There was a lot of serious discussion, specifically among the women, among the students, about, you know, the efficacy of maybe having some personal protection. But I think it became quickly apparent that the cons outweighed the pros. And, you know, there's been so many, you know, anecdotal situations in which, you know, pissed off students came in and took out their... So, yeah, it just seems on its face just a really bad idea.
Well, there's also beyond anecdotal, there's actually material evidence that more people get hurt and killed accidentally by legal guns that are around the house than perpetrators stop from committing crimes as a result of guns. So, I mean, there's evidence. But go ahead.
Well, and I'm also, I mean, we're just talking about the college campus part, but it's a good microcosm to discuss. That age group of young people is also the age group where they're most likely to have onset of depression, bipolar, or any other anxiety, other kinds of mental illness. That's already complicated enough by youth, but for them to also have guns in their hands, they're more likely to hurt themselves also. So it's really it's again. I mean, I feel like I've said this 80 times, but this is unsafe for our children.
What's the reasoning behind all of this? Because at the moment, concealed weapons are legal in the state, but that universities, public universities, have the right to make their own decision about this. This is what would go away in this bill. But also parks, public recreation areas, and bars. What's the rationale behind expanding the number of spaces?
Well, I think that some Republicans who are in favor of this, and I'm just going to say some Republicans because I know that they're not all in favor of it. I think they're testing limits. I think, you know, certainly there are people who would like to see guns in more places. And I think, you know, those are the people who are trying to push this bill forward.
Because there is a limit. You can have it in a recreation area, but not a playground. So if there's a playground next to it, you have to put your gun back in your locked car. You can't take it with you to the playground, I think, under this legislation, right? Playgrounds, no gun. Recreation area adjacent, you can have the gun.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, so...
But bullets travel.
Bullets sure travel, recreation areas. It's hard to know what's going on. Well, let me talk about that, because you say there's some discomfort among Republicans with some of this legislation. They're not unanimous in all of it. In fact, a number of cases where there were committee votes that were voice votes that have been contested. Contested because there's a thought that the measure didn't pass in committee, that there were enough Republicans opposed to keep it from passing.
Right. Well, I think actually the perfect example of that is the bill that would mandate this particular teaching of abortion. So I was sitting in that committee, and you could not only hear the discomfort among the committee, you could hear discomfort and see it among everyone in the room. And there was a wide spectrum, obviously, of people in that committee room on both sides of the aisle. There were all kinds of people there. And at least one Republican senator expressed concerns about saying that abortion is a cause of preterm births. He just didn't agree. But what happened was the committee chair really wanted to push that vote through, and he asked for a voice vote, which to everyone in the room sounded incredibly close, but he didn't take account. And so it was his decision to push that forward. So I think that's one indication, you know, we're seeing the fault lines, I think, you know, if you're just talking about Republicans, we're seeing some of those fault lines, and they pop up in different ways.
Well, one of the ways they've popped up is on Facebook with the House Speaker, a Republican, warning his fellow Republicans that they are overreaching, they're acting just as the Democrats did in the decade previous, and if they don't watch their step, they're in trouble. House Speaker Tom Tillis warning fellow Republicans on Facebook. What's happening there? What's the reception to that? What are you hearing on the Hill about that warning and how it's being received?
Well, I think it's pretty clear if you spend just a little bit of time at the General Assembly that there is a really big difference between the leadership in the House and the Senate. And Speaker of the House Tom Tillis is, you know, has said things, you know, he hasn't made the overreaching comment previously, but he is presenting himself as a more moderate, business-friendly kind of guy. And Senate President Phil Berger has been more hardline, particularly in this session. He's brought forth ideas that are that, you know, I think people would say are farther on the right. And so there are big differences between the leadership just in those two chambers. And it's very clear. It's very obvious.
Let me just go around the panel quickly and talk about that. This is a Democratic process. We have a Republican legislature and governor, and this is the legislation we're hearing. In other words, the people have spoken. Laurel and Dossett, you have all expressed your concerns about this legislation. But this is apparently the will of the people of North Carolina. What would you say about that?
Well, I don't agree with that. I know that they are our elected officials, but I do agree with Jennifer that there is a certain amount of limit testing here in terms of having both the governorship and the full House, that they're just getting to do, you know, and say whatever they like, and that is the process. I'm bad about using nature metaphors, and I've been trying to think this week. There's a thing that occurs in nature, in trees in particular, when they're very stressed and they're about to die, that they bloom out and they basically put forth all their seeds and propagate themselves before they go away. And I keep – this is a little bit too beautiful of a metaphor for what's happening right now. But I, in a way, I do believe that what's happening is – you know, regressive, patriarchal, old school, and is not our future.
And it's going to be on your next CD, no doubt.
That's right.
That song.
The Death Bloom.
Right. Randall?
Well, it's fairly early on, 5 months into this new administration, and they're coming on like gangbusters. I mean, the acceleration is kind of, it's hard to keep up with. And I think that people will be looking at the gerrymandering, the districts, so many of these people got into office, because demographically the state is much more purple than we like to admit.
Ellen, I would like to give you time, but I'm out. So I have to say thank you. Can you do it in 10 seconds?
I think this is a backlash against Obama.
On the State of Things today, I want to thank you very much for being on the program, Ellen O'Hara Slavik, who is a graphic artist and whose latest book is called Hiroshima, Laurel Lynn Dossett, singer-songwriter, latest CD, The Gathering, Randall Keenan, English professor at UNC, editor of The Cross of Redemption, The Uncollected Writings of James Baldwin. Great to have all of you on the program today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jessica Jones, WUNC's
Thanks.
Capital Bureau Chief. Thanks. Coming up, the music of Birds and Arrows. Stay tuned.